As usual, let us all take a moment before we begin today's sermon to remind ourselves of how extremely fortunate we are to be in receipt of the teaching of the Buddha, to be the recipients of the legacy that has been left behind by our great ancestors, the Theras and Theris who blessed this land. Let us remind ourselves of how fortunate we are to be students of the great master, the omniscient one, the most magnificent one, the perfectly enlightened one, the fully awakened one, the unparalleled one, the unequaled one, the infinitely victorious one. The Supreme Buddha. It is because of our merits, tremendous merits, that we are today able to receive his teaching and to walk the path that he has taught us. So therefore, let us not rest on our laurels. Let us understand and appreciate how fortunate we are. Let us renew our pledge of allegiance to the Lord Buddha as his disciples, reflecting on the infinite virtues, on the infinite compassion, infinite wisdom that he possessed, and reminding ourselves of how unique we are to be students, to be disciples of the one and only Gautama Supreme Buddha. Let us be upstanding then to recite the stanzas which were once uttered by the householder Upali in veneration to his name. When asked, "Whose disciple are you?" Let us commemorate that day as if it were today. Imagine you are asked the question, "Whose disciple are you?" With pride, honor, dignity. Let us proclaim that we are the disciples of the Gautama Buddha. Dhirasya vigata mohasya pabhinna khilasya vijita vijayasya anighasya susama cittasya buddha silasya sadhu panyasya vesantarasya vimalasya bhagavato tasya savako hamasmi akatankatissa tusitassa vantalokamisassa muditassa katasamanassa manujassa antimasarirassa narassa anupamassa virajassa bhagavato tassa savako hamasmi asansayassa kulassa venaikassa sarati varasya anuttarasya ruchira dhammasya nikhankasya abhasakarasya manachidasya virasya bhagavato tasya savakohamasmi nisabhasya appameyasya gambhirasya munapatasya khemankarasya vedasya dhammattasya sanguttattasya sangatigasya muttasya bhagavato tasya savakohamasmi nagasya pantasenasya khinasanyojanasya muttasya patimantakasya dhonasya pannadhajasya vitaragasya dantasya nippapanchasya bhagavato tasya savakohamasmi nagasya pantasenasya khinasanyojanasya muttasya patimantakasya dhonasya pannadhajasya vitaragasya dantasya nippapanchasya bhagavato tasya savakohamasmi namo tasya bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasya namo tasya bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasya namo tasya bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasya to observe the precepts and seek refuge in the Noble Triple Gem. Please repeat all together and after me. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Saraṇāgamanaṃ sampunnaṃ. Pānātipātā vēramanī sikkhāpadaṃ samādhiyāmi. Adinnadana Veramani Sikkhapadam Samadhiyami. Kamesu Michachara Veramani Sikkhapadam Samadhiyami. Musavada Veramani Sikkhapadam Samadhiyami. Surameraya Majjapama Dattana Veramani Sikkhapadam Samadhiyami. Tisaranena saddhim panchasilam dhammam sadukham surakhitam kratva apamadena sampadeta. Okay, you may all now be seated. Also, before we commence, let us take a moment to invite the celestial beings, the divine beings, who reside in the 10,000 world systems that are within earshot, beings who have some hope of listening to the teaching of the Buddha, rejoicing in this merit, and delivering themselves from suffering. Let us remind ourselves that those who we are about to invite are not just any old sentient beings. Among them will be our parents, our siblings, best of friends, teachers, our elders, people who will have gone the extra mile to help us in the most challenging times of our lives, in this long journey that we have come in samsara. Take a moment to remind yourself of how many people will have helped you in just this birth to be where you are today, to help you out of difficult situations. If so many people have had to come to your rescue in only this birth, imagine the countless beings without whose help, support, guidance, assistance, you couldn't even imagine to have lived a comfortable life, or at least lived at all. These are the people who today may be absolutely anywhere in samsara, in these 10,000 world systems. Gods, deities, or perhaps demigods. Perhaps those beings who are not so fortunate to have been born in the blissful plane. But as you owe them a duty, as you owe them a debt, upon receiving your invitation, they're prepared to come. They're prepared to come to receive the merits, to rejoice in these merits. So therefore, let us extend this opportunity to them, reminding ourselves of this fact that without them, we would have been nowhere. With a token of gratitude, to repay the debts that we owe them, with compassion towards all of them. As I now make this invitation, I want you all to extend that invitation out to all of them. invite them to join us and witness this meritorious deed, such that if any of them have today been born in woeful plains, may they rejoice in these merits and free themselves and be born in the blissful plain. And for all beings in the blissful plain, may they accept this invitation to receive the gift that excels all gifts, the opportunity to open their wisdom eye and see the truth as it is, to realize the noble truths, and to free themselves from samsara once and for all. Samanta chakravalesu atra gacchantu devata saddhammam munirajas sunanto saggamokkhadam dhamma savana kalo ayam bhadanta dhamma savana kalo ayam bhadanta dhamma savana kalo ayam bhadanta. Let us also take a moment to remind ourselves that although today we are in the association of noble ones, good and kind-hearted people, and thus we are today the same, and we rank among them. In this long journey in samsara, we have not always been so fortunate. Virtually always we have been in the association of immoral, ignoble ones, those associations which defiled our minds with raga, dvesha and moha, desire, aversion and delusion, and having been blinded with ignorance and attachment, many countless times we will have committed offenses towards them, the noble ones. The consequences of such actions may be that today, although we have great will and a great desire to listen to the Dhamma, to remain alert and vigilant throughout our practice, and to achieve the noble attainments, the consequences of our actions hinder our progress. They block our path and make it that much more difficult to do so. This is why we always take a moment to seek forgiveness, to acknowledge our faults, our errors, and also to promise ourselves to never conduct ourselves in that manner again. So, let us all take a moment to remind ourselves that we have not always been the kind-hearted, generous, good souls that we are today. Countless times we may have offended, insulted, desecrated, reviled the noble ones, the Sammasambuddhas, Paccheka Buddhas, Arahatta Buddhas, Anagami, Sakrudagami, Sotapannas, be they on the path of having attained the fruits, as well as the Buddhas, ministry, the Sambuddha Shasane, for any thoughts, words or actions of offense, desecration, revile, slander or insult we might have directed towards them. May I be forgiven. And as you seek that forgiveness, I urge you to make a solemn promise to yourself, never to be broken, to the effect that you shall never conduct yourself in that manner ever again. So let us all take a moment to do that now. And finally, let us all make a firm resolve. May the merits that we have all committed throughout our journey in samsara come to our rescue at this moment, come to see us well, see us through, come to help us understand the Dhamma and to help us free ourselves once and for all from the four great hells and achieve the noble state of Sotapanna. And for any of you who may have already achieved that noble state, may through the course of this sermon you be able to fulfill the subsequent stages and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. With that firm resolve in mind, I invite you all to prepare yourselves to listen to this sermon. The fifth of the 10 stanzas that was uttered by the household of Pali almost 2.5 centuries ago. You must all know the first four by heart now. And most of you will be getting the hang of the fifth. And I know there are some among you who will know all 10 by heart, because these are stanzas that we have been reciting in our Sinhala sermons for a long time. And it was also particularly worth mentioning yourselves that requested for these stanzas to be made available in the English sermons also. And ever since, I've been sharing them with you at the start of the sermons in no less than 2 or 3 sermons. We even went through their meanings of the first four at least. And we discussed what might have prompted Upali, the householder, to answer in this way when questioned. In fact, it was his integrity that was questioned. He had been a lifelong disciple of another religious leader. Whose ways he realized were not for him. In fact, if you remember the story, it was that particular religious leader, that was Nigantha Nathaputta, who had prompted Upali to go and engage in a debate with the Buddha, to defeat him in that debate. Because Nigantha Nathaputta considered the Buddha his competitor, his rival. So he always sensed that there was a rivalry between them. And he always wanted to, in his mind, protect his disciples, his followers, from falling, within air quotes, victim to the Buddha and his disciples. The Buddha was going round the country, as were his disciples, the great arahants, roaming the country, roaming the surface of this earth, and blessing it with their every footstep, blessing the lives of every man, woman, and child, with every word that they uttered, with every spoonful of alms that was offered to them, with every worship, with every veneration. And this is very unsettling for Nigantanatha Buddha. So he made various efforts to ensure that his disciples would remain loyal to him. But unfortunately, not through the Buddha's efforts by any means, he was never one to approach disciples of other religious leaders and invite them to join his shasana. Rather, all he did was preach the truth. He showed things as they were. And all he said was, you have to make your own mind up. I cannot ferry you across. I can show you how to make your own boat. I can show you, I can teach you how to make yourself an oar. And then I can show you how I ferried myself across this river of samsara. And then, good man, it is up to you to do it for yourself. If my methods seem acceptable to you, if they seem logical to you, if they seem practical to you, if they seem righteous to you, then you may decide for yourself to follow this path, to follow this method. And that is all I have for you. I do not expect you to be a follower of mine, to come behind me, to give me alms, to worship me, to show me respect, to venerate me, to praise me, and none of these things. Because he had gone a long way, and having left behind those silly infatuations which cursed the mind of those men and women with fetters. Because he was one who had cast off the fetters. He was someone who was emancipated. He was someone who had no issue being in seclusion, as he was free of desire. He was a sage. He had subdued himself. He was free from all obsessions. He was faultless. Of course, Upali, the householder, didn't know any of this until he went and had the debate with the Buddha. In the first few words that he exchanged in their conversation, he was utterly impressed. And he knew then and there that he had found what he had been looking for his entire life. He realized who stood in front of him was someone who possessed the power of insight, the power of wise discussion. He realized that no teacher that he had ever come across until such time, let alone Nigantanatha Buddha, was anywhere near, could come anywhere near to this great person that he had finally met. So is it any wonder then, when on their final meeting. Nigantanatha Putta asks this householder Upali, come clean, tell me the truth. Is it true that you are going around and telling people that you are no longer my disciple? Is it true what the country folk say? You have always been my disciple. You have been my chief benefactor. It is true. Is it true then that you have become disloyal to me? He who I sent you to meet, to engage in debate and prove, is flawed in his thinking. Doesn't know what he's talking about. He's foolish. Is it true that having spoken with him, having engaged in debate with him, you have lost to him? Are you guilty of that shameful act? Would have been some of the words that Nigantanatha Putta might have shared with Upali. So is it in wonder, when asked these questions, Upali's response in return was of him who is faultless and abides in seclusion, has cast off the fetters, is emancipated. He's a sage who possesses the power of wise discussion, has cast away his banner, is free of desire, subdued and free from obsessions. Of that blessed one, I am a disciple. He was only speaking his personal, first-hand experience. This was not hearsay. Unlike you and I, who may perhaps be reciting these stanzas off a page printed on a book, which has passed down, a message which was passed down 2,500 years. Unlike us, this man who uttered it for the first time was speaking his first-hand experience, because he had met him. He was there when it happened. He had the good fortune of meeting him, the perfect one. It is important, as you recite these stanzas, folks, that you reflect on these meanings as best you can. I'd be the first to admit that these translations are not perfect. I don't think I can ever make them perfect. These are words that describe the Buddha. A few of them. Each of these words contain, encapsulate his virtues, his wisdom, his magnificence, his gracefulness. To the extent of infinity. So how is it that we can contain it in a few syllables? That is an impossible task. But nevertheless, it is still important, as you recite these gathas, these stanzas, that you make an effort to reflect on the meanings of them, or their meanings. And that is why I have made them available to you on each screen. There is a subscript just beneath the Pali. The English meanings. And as you reflect on them, this reflection needs also to be turned towards you. Do you remember the sermon? Are you a blessed one? So that sermon, the core of it was inspired by one of these stanzas. Because it was Upali who once said, of that blessed one, I am a disciple. And then we discussed among ourselves, what does it mean to be a blessed one? How does one become a blessed one? And that is why I asked you, are you a blessed one? Which one are you? In a world where people want to be someone, people want to be someone with a banner. A banner says who you are. It is me, this is I. This is my way. This is my country. This is myself. This is my identity. This is who I am. And don't you mistake that for anyone else. All of these things are mine. This is where I belong, and I belong here. This is my banner, and forever it shall bear evidence of that. But the Buddha was someone who had cast away his banner. He'd gone from someone to practically no one. And in that transformation from someone to no one, he had actually become someone to everyone. So that is how you can become someone to everyone. You've got to become a no one. Are you someone then who is working towards these goals that you see on screen? These are goals. They are very much indeed. Are you working towards becoming faultless? At least to the best you can. Of course, arahants may be left with residual defilements. It is impossible to become entirely faultless unless one becomes a supreme Buddha. But shouldn't stop you from trying the best you can. Are you someone who's trying to become emancipated, free, by casting off your fetters, the fetters that keep you bound to samsara? Are you a sage? Are you someone who people come to for sage advice? Are you someone who people come to for respite? When they are lost, when they need direction in their life, are you someone who people come to? And when they do you possess the power of wise discussion? Do you possess the intellect, the intelligence, the wisdom to pave out a path for them and to help them guide themselves from wherever they are, absolutely wherever they might be, to where they need to be? That is someone who possesses the power of wise discussion. Are you working to free yourself of desire? Are you working to subdue your defilements and free yourself from obsessions? These are the characteristics of a blessed one. So now we know 10 more characteristics of a blessed one. You knew 40, now you know 50. Before long, you will know 60. But how many of that 50 have you set yourself as personal goals, personal ambitions? That is the question that you need to find an answer to. You know, it is one thing to go through the books, the manuscripts, to find out, to find hymns and praises of our great forefathers, of the Buddha, of the Arahants, and then sing our hearts out in praise and veneration for them. But if you were to really ask them, what do you expect of me, Venerable Sir? Just as I said earlier, when the Buddha and his disciples roamed this planet, going from place to place, home to home, country to country, village to village, town to town, household to household, person to person, melting hearts of stone, putting out fires of desire, bending those who are obstinate, helping those who thought they were forever stuck in their ways. Not once did he expect any of them to repay any of those debts. By offering him meals, by offering him robes, by offering him shelter, he allowed people to do them only because they would bring them merits, and such merits would help them free themselves from the suffering that they had got themselves into, the snares that they would have gotten themselves into. That is why he allowed them to do them. So, all he expected in his time and today from all of us is to be as close as we can like him, to become like him. To become as close as we possibly can. To him. To possess his qualities. To possess these qualities. So that is what we must strive for. So this is why I say, when you recite these stanzas, I want you to remember that it is important for you to take a moment to reflect on their meanings and ask yourselves, hand on heart, am I making a genuine effort? Am I doing all I possibly can to become like him? Because it is then the Buddha can someday say, you have become at least somewhat like me. You have come close enough to me that I can today utter and proclaim that you are my son, you are my daughter. For the Buddha to be able to say this, you have to become like him, like father, like son. So if you want to become his son, you have to be like the Father. You have to be like him. And we know what he's like. This is what he's like. Our ancestors have shared this with us. So, for years to come, ourselves and future generations will know what our Father was like. That is why they have been passed down from generation to generation in the form of the Tripitaka. So we know what our Father was like. So that for 5,000 years, from his passing away, somewhere, someplace, some man on this planet will always know what he was like. We are lucky that we are only halfway through that journey. We are so lucky. Imagine if you were born 2,500 years from today, the very tail end of the Sasanya, where we would only have the Kasavakantakas, those men who would bear a thread around their upper bodies, around their necks, to resemble that they are disciples of the Buddha. Perhaps if we were born then, the tail end, it would have been incredibly difficult to understand the Dhamma. Not because of Arupada, but because the Dhamma is almost non-existent. But today we are in a very fortunate place. We have the Dhamma, we have the Sangha, we have Nibbana. In essence, that is what the Buddha is. It is Nibbana. We have the Noble Triple Gem. So when everything is available to us, the only missing piece of the puzzle is, I'm sure you can work that out. So, what I ask you is, whenever we recite these stanzas, all five of them and more in the future, take a moment to glance at the meanings and ask yourself, how close am I today than I was the previous week, 2 weeks ago, a month ago, 6 months ago, to possessing these characteristics? Because that is what makes the difference. I want to take one of the questions that have come through, as I thought that question may open up some avenues for us to further proceed our discussion so far in the Dhamma. It is somewhat related to some of the things we spoke of last week, with someone sharing with us some of their goals and saying that one of the things they wanted to stop doing this year was watching videos on the internet and snacking from time to time. So this question is somewhat related to that. It might be from the same person, maybe it's from another person, another one of our listeners. Either way, I thought it has two parts, I think, this question, and it should open up some avenues for us to continue our conversation. Peruvan Samnai Swami Nuhansa, I have a problem. Now, this gentleman or this lady has, you can see that this question has been prompted by actually doing one of the things that I've asked them to do. Of course, that is always the way it works. If you do what we ask you to do, then the path from there on becomes very obvious. It becomes clearer. Results are for those who do. I'll say that a million times. Results are for those who do. Failure is for those who don't bother. I have a problem. I checked my YouTube history, as advised by Swami Nuhansa. and I found out my desires. For watching films and other stuff are still the same. Actually, every time I go on YouTube to watch them, I keep trying to apply the Dhamma practically as best as I understand. But most of the time, I cannot apply the Dhamma. In the moment I desire something, I know at the end of the act it is useless. So you can read into what this person is trying to express and get the long and the short of it. I know at the end of the act it is useless and nothing to be gained, but I don't have the courage to shift my mind from the desire to contemplation of the Dhamma. So in the heat of the moment, essentially what they're saying is, I'm finding it, I'm going to say it's a he, just for the sake of the discussion, makes it easier for us. So what he's saying is, it's easier, or rather they find it difficult, he finds it difficult to apply the Dhamma in the moment. To switch when the mind starts to wander and roam aimlessly, and then it gets ensnared. And then it's difficult to switch back. Those of you who listen to the single sermons will remember the importance of 10 seconds. If you are familiar with Sinhala, then I will also urge you to listen to the Sinhala sermons whenever you get the chance. These sermons don't always go hand in hand, although they come from the same voice. As I said, there's no someone doing these sermons, it's what comes when it comes. That's the way it works. So sometimes the themes that are discussed are entirely different. All Nibbana, all to do with the Buddha Dhamma, but sometimes they go in various different avenues. Sometimes the single sermon, which is usually recorded sometime in the middle of the week, and this English sermon, which is on a Sunday, although it's the same week, sometimes the things we talk about are worlds apart. So for those of you who can understand Sinhala, I would encourage you to listen to those sermons as well. I don't know what your time schedules are, but if you can, it's always worthwhile. So there we talked about the importance of 10 seconds. What happens in 10 seconds? What can happen in 10 seconds? And how 10 seconds can save you? It was a second-by-second analysis. What can happen in 10 seconds? So, actually, Swami Nohansa, at that moment, I asked my mind the question, why do you want to indulge in it? I like the use of the word indulge, because it probably has some connection to the sermon entitled Indulgence. Then the answer comes as it gives you pleasure. So in the moment, he asks his mind the question, why do you want to indulge in it? And the answer comes, it gives you pleasure. But before I can think, my mind jumps into indulgence. So before, essentially what he's saying is, before I can work out the mechanics of pleasure and work it through and really contemplate on the truth, the mind has already jumped. When it comes to some desires, the body reacts before the mind. So I think it's becoming obvious what this problem might be. The body reacts before the mind, so it's very hard to remind myself of the foolishness of indulgence, Swami Nansa. On my side, I might still not get the meaninglessness of pleasure because I still want to experience this pleasure. What can I do about this, Swami? Answer, please can you point out my weakness and give me some advice to help with this problem. Much merits to you. Terwan Sarmay. I think it's a very pertinent question and a very, very practical question. I always appreciate questions like this because they're very practical. Yeah, that is the duty of the Mahasangha, to help those who need help. So, to help those who really know they need help. And I think this question, assuming it comes from a gentleman, most certainly a listener, they're asking for help. And it is our duty to help. So, the essence of this problem is, it seems clear to me that he has some understanding of the Dhamma. This is why he's talking about pleasure and indulgence and the uselessness of that and desire and the need to contemplate and the practical application, all that. He also knows that this is a weakness. Was it last week or the week before we discussed this, the saying that people have, the mind is willing but the flesh is weak. And so there is some reference to that here as well. When it comes to some desires, the body reacts before the mind. So it's hard to remind my mind of the foolishness of indulgence. Well, let's take some time to work out if that is really the case. Does the body react before the mind? Does it? Because before we fix the problem, we need to first identify where the problem is. Otherwise, we're going about fixing the wrong problem. You know, if it's the body that's the culprit here, the body is mischievous, then I suppose one of the easiest things you could do is tie yourself up, and that should solve the problem. Or lock yourself somewhere, maybe put handcuffs around your wrists, and that should solve the problem. Right? Because now the body can't react before the mind. But does that solve the problem? Remember, cetanaham bhikkave kammam vadami. Karma is in volition. It's not in the act. It's in intention. Intention is not in your wrists, or your hands, or your fingers, or your toes, or your eyes, or your nose, or your mouth, or your tongue. You can't find intention anywhere in your physical body. Intention is not in the body. Intention is in the mind. And the Buddha says that intention is the karma. It is the deed itself. So there is no point trying to discipline the body without taming the mind. Even if someone says, you know, until I understand the Dhamma, I'm going to try and discipline my body. That is also not disciplining the body, it's actually disciplining the mind. Because the mind works, it has three avenues. The mind can stop at thinking things, which is the Manosankara. The mind can stop at saying things, which is the Vachisankara. Vachisankara is more the words being constructed in the mind, but for simplicity's sake, let's say it's the uttering of the words, and the mind can stop at, well, it's not stopping then, it's gone all the way at doing things, kaya sankara. With all three of these, it is the intention, and the intention is in the mind. So whenever something has been said, and you say, oops, that was a slip of the tongue. It wasn't really a slip of the tongue. You're attributing fault to your tongue, and you're saying that's a slip of the tongue, but it's not really. That was the mind. What happened was, the mind did something, and soon after it realized its mistake. Before it realized its mistake, Mano Sankara, Vachi Sankara and Kaya Sankara happened, and the mistake was made. And then soon after it realized, and now it's too late to pull it back. Then you say, oops, that was a slip of the tongue. That was not a slip of the tongue. It was a slip of the mind. It was a mind slip. So sometimes when I'm going to assume that this is probably relatively young individual. That's only an assumption, gauging from the nature of the question. But that doesn't necessarily have to be true. Right from a very young age to a day before you pass away. If these defilements remain in the mind, then there is no escape. Whenever there is vexation, there will need to be relief from vexation. And mind, body and speech will all have to be used for that purpose. But I would assume that a lot of you who perhaps find yourself in this situation where you're watching something on the internet, not the films, maybe the other stuff, whatever this other stuff might be. And in the moment, the desire is too strong and the body reacts. At the end of all that, becomes obvious that it was useless and nothing was gained. But in that period of time, between start and end, mentally, you weren't strong enough to change and alter the cause of action, the cause of events. And then sometimes, at the end of it, you blame someone innocent, that is the body, and says, well, I tried really hard, but hey, it was the body. The body reacted before the mind. So, I just didn't have time, the mind didn't have time to contemplate on the Dhamma. So the body is to blame. For as long as you keep blaming the innocent, the guilty party is never going to learn a lesson. So, let us first come to our senses and vindicate those who are innocent and victimize those who are guilty. Let's identify the real culprit. So point out my weakness is this gentleman's request. That I'll do. Let's talk through how something like that could happen. To do that, I'm going to use this board, whiteboard. It's been a while since I used it. Let's see if I've still got the knack for it. Right. Okay. You should be able to see that. Right. This is my stick man. Okay. Now, what we're trying to work out is this hypothesis. Is it the mind or is it the body? So the hypothesis is the mind is willing, but the flesh is weak. The mind is willing, but the flesh is weak. We are going to test this hypothesis. Is this the case? Okay. Right. So, for the sake of and in the interest of everyone on the sermon, I am conscious that we have young children on the sermon also. I'm going to use an example of something that is palatable for everyone. That's my surprise, because it looks everything like a piece of cake. That's why. Right, so we have a piece of cake on a stool, in a plate, and what we are trying to test is if the mind is willing and the flesh is weak, or is it perhaps that the flesh is willing but the mind is weak? One of these two things we have to be able to prove at the end of this experiment. The flesh is willing, but the mind is weak. Okay? I'm going to take our time with this, because I want you to follow it through carefully. And once you understand this, whichever one we agree to go with, you must promise me that you will never, ever use the one that we have proved as false as an excuse. Does that sound reasonable? So, for instance, if we prove that it is in fact the mind that is willing but the flesh is weak, I will not expect you, and I will expect you not to ever say that, Swaminathan sir, what can I do? The mind was not willing. Or if we agree that it is in fact the flesh that is willing, but the mind is weak, then I will not have you say to me in future, Swaminathan sir, I was ready to stop it, but my body, it just wouldn't listen. Just didn't want to play ball. It just went for it. And I was helpless. I couldn't stop myself. So when you say, I couldn't stop myself, that's an interesting thing to consider, isn't it? I couldn't stop myself. It's a very interesting statement that. I couldn't stop myself. Oftentimes, you will have said that. It's a favorite excuse for some people. I just couldn't stop myself. It was happening. I was helpless. Because then it's very easy to when you say I couldn't stop myself, this I becomes faultless, doesn't it? Now that's what happens. I am faultless because it's myself who's guilty. That's somebody else. This is I. I'm faultless. So myself is probably the body. And I just couldn't stop it. So I'm helpless. I couldn't stop myself. Right, let's work through this example and see which one's which. Is the mind that is willing and the flesh is weak? Or is it the flesh that is willing but the mind is weak? So we go back to our piece of cake. Right, neatly and very temptingly laid out on a dish, on a pedestal. And this is you. Now, what would normally happen is when you see something like this and you think, ooh, cake. The arm extends forward, the fingers grab hold of the piece of cake, and as if you are under a spell, as if you were possessed by the cake demon, this cake comes to your mouth. And all the while, now you want to stop it, right? Isn't this how it works out? Now, I'm talking about cake, and I want the gentleman who's asked the question to relate it to his question. Okay? So that's the way we're going to work this through. What was the question again? I have a desire for watching films and other stuff. And every time I watch them, I try to apply the Dhamma as practically as I can, and I have understood the Dhamma. But most of the time, I cannot apply it at the moment when I desire something. Right, so we're talking about cake and the moment when you desire it. I know at the end of the act, it is useless and nothing to be gained, but I don't have the courage to shift my mind from the desire to contemplation. I ask myself the question, why do you want to indulge in it? And the answer that comes back is, because it gives you pleasure. But before I can think, my mind jumps into indulgence. And when it comes to some desires, the body reacts before the mind. So it's hard to remind my mind. Of course, the mind has no time now. Why? The body has already reacted. It's hard to remind my mind of the foolishness of indulgence. On my side, I might still not get the meaningless of pleasure because I want to experience the pleasure. What can I do about this forming answer? And please can you point out my weakness? That's exactly what we're going to be doing with this piece of cake. This harmless, this innocent piece of cake. Isn't it? So, we find ourselves in this situation. There's a piece of cake. And as if by force, your arm starts to extend towards it. You ever been in that situation? Like, go back in time and think of a similar kind of situation, because then it will be easier for you to follow this train of thought. Right? I want all of you to take a moment now. Go back in time and find an example from your lives where you found yourself in a similar situation. I'll give you a few seconds. Go back and find one of those confounding experiences from your life where you just couldn't work out what the hell was going on, where you wanted to stop but your body was not willing to pay any attention to what you had to say, as if you were in someone else's body. And you were saying, stop, stop, stop. And the body was not prepared to listen. It just went with the motions. Everyone, I want you all to go back and think of an example like that. And then I'm going to tell you the story of cake, and you can substitute that with cake. I'll help jog your memory if you are struggling to come up with an example. It could be like this gentleman who's posed the question to us when you were on the infamous internet. We know what the internet now is, right? We talked about this a few weeks ago. What is the internet? It's where everything is. Where is everything? It's on the internet. That's right. So when you were on the internet and your mind said, yeah, okay, that's the news. Yeah, that's the emails, checked. Yeah, that's the weather report. Yep, checked. That's my shopping cart. Right, done. Ooh, what's this page? Hang on, don't need this. This is not right. So Amin Mahansa says, this is not right. And I know this is not right. Right, let's get off this page. What are you doing? Let's get off this page. What are you doing? Why are you clicking on that? Hello? Stop? Can you hear me? Anyone here? Stop. What are you doing? Why did you just click on that? Right? That may be one example in your lives. Another could be maybe when you were shopping. Right? You were walking down the aisles and maybe you went perfume shopping or buying something nice for yourself, maybe a nice dress. You'd already done your shopping. I mean, that was enough clothes for 150 years, for three generations, right? And you are still walking down the aisles, and then you see this new thing. This is the latest trend. You only saw it yesterday on one of the teledramas, right? Some new actor or actress wore it and you thought, oh, that looked nice, and now you see it in the store. Now what happens? Now your mind is saying, yeah, but come on, you know, we've already bought enough, right? This is enough for a lifetime. We don't need any more. All right, let's go. And, you know, hey, what are you doing? I said, let's go. What are you doing now? Why are you putting your, you know, we're not even going to try it on. Why are you bothering? Why are you taking it off the hanger? Hey, come on, dude, stop that. Why are you putting it in the basket? What is the problem with you? Are you thick? What are you doing? You've been in that situation, haven't you? Particularly the ladies in the house. And sometimes it's perfumes, bottle of perfumes. Right? Someone said once about French perfumes, how they had an addiction. And now they've managed to break from that addiction. Remember? Well done. So you walk past again the eyes and there's the perfume. And you know what they do? They just spray it all around, don't they? The storekeepers. On those little cards. And you walk. If you walk 10 yards, within 10 yards of the perfume shop, it smells like you walked into the Chatur Maharajike. And of course, then there's no turning back. Have you been there? And then, you know, your mind is saying, right, that's the exit. Yes, that way. Yes, straight ahead, exit. Feet, what are you doing? Why are you turning right? We're supposed to go straight. Feet, hello. Yeah, been there? Yeah, been there, done that, bought the t-shirt? Well done. Yeah, I'm talking about that. I want you to come up with one of those examples in life. It could be a sight, it could be a sound, smell, taste. And it's very dangerous if you go all the way as far as touch. Oh boy. Some people say you can look but you don't touch, because if you touch you get burnt. Some can get very serious sometimes. You end up with a red eye or a black eye, a red face, broken teeth, all sorts of things can happen. Has it happened to you ever? And the mind says, come on, hey, dude, you know, you're engaged, right? You've got a girlfriend. What are you doing? Right? Move. Get out of the bus now. What are you doing? Why do you need to go and sit next to her? Like, there are plenty of seats on the bus. Why do you need to go and sit next to her? And besides, you've got a girlfriend. What would she wouldn't approve? Like, out. Get out of the bus now. What are you doing? Legs. Hey. Out. No. That way. Exit that way. Help. Been there? So each of these occasions prove to you what? That the mind was willing but the flesh was weak, right? Or perhaps something more domestic, something more innocent. You're sitting at home watching the TV, it's time to switch it off. You know you've got to hit bed at 10 o'clock. But this is pre-bedtime TV, right? From 9:45 onwards, you decided, right, it's time to switch off the television. It's now 9:55. You've already gone 10 minutes over. And then you know exactly the off button on the remote, that you've pressed it 100 times now. You've got enough practice of it now. But it's as if you don't even know that such a button exists on the remote. Like, you press every other button, don't you? Except for the off button. You been there? And the next time you pick up the remote, you're telling yourself, yeah, okay, finally, we're going to press the off button. Right? All the way to the front. Okay, now, index finger, yes, all the way to the front. No, not there. All the way to, why did you just press on number 10? Mind is willing, but the flesh is weak, isn't it? Let's find out. So I'm going to go with cake. You can go with Kate, if you want. That is what happened to you. Right? I'm going to go eat cake. So, lovely piece of cake on a dish, on a pedestal, and mind says what? Now, I really like, what's his name? Freud. So, most people know Freud, have at least heard of him. He was he's considered to be the father of psychology. The Western world, at least, consider him the father of psychology. You'll know from his psychoanalysis, he speaks of the mind and he speaks of the unconscious mind and the conscious mind. And any of you who've done any study into psychology will know that he speaks of the iceberg. Right? So it's something like this. This is not me trying to teach you Freudian theory, but just so, you know, how people try to interpret these impulses. And basically what he's saying is, the mind is something like this, right? So you've got the id, which is essentially that voice in the back of your mind going, you know, go on, eat it, take it, have it. You want it, have it. Right? It's yours, take it. Right? It's all that stuff. That's your id. Then you have the ego, which is the good side of the mind. So that's going and saying, so essentially, I'm just going to draw it go back to the iceberg, right? So you have the id, and then you have the ego, and you have the superego. So you have the id, which says, do all this stuff, eat, sleep, right? It's yours to take, go and take it. And then you have the ego, which says, no, you shouldn't be doing that. Yeah, this is bad. You know, you should be good. You should leave it for others. It's the angel, if you like, and the id being the devil, if you like. And then you have the superego, which, according to Freud, is the bit that has to balance between these two, the right and wrong. Now, we're talking about a similar concept here, but not in his terms. We're talking about how you have experienced this firsthand, where there's a voice at the back of your mind that's driving your arm, it's pushing your body, it's making you reach out for the cake. But then there's also a voice in the back of your mind that's saying, no, don't do that. And that is the bit that you're saying is weak. Whereas the other voice is the bit that you're saying is fierce, it's strong, it's too strong. And then therefore you say that the flesh is weak. Let's work out how this happens. I'm going to, for the sake of this, I'm just going to take out the cake for a moment. Let me see if I can do that. Oh, yeah. That's clever, isn't it? Right. So now, let's imagine, now I'm just going to forget the cake for a moment, okay? Let's imagine, in any normal situation, okay, we'll come back to the cake. Can you just forget cake for a moment? Right. So in any normal situation, let's say this, so this being this is a thumb, so that makes this a little finger. Right, that's the little finger. So that then has to be the index finger, and that's the middle finger, right? Okay, so let's imagine, folks, that I ask you to raise your arm. I ask you to raise your arm. So essentially, at the end of this, you've got to look like this. Okay? So I ask you to raise your arm. So I want you to go from this state to this state. What's going on here? It is the arm that was raised, wasn't it? Wasn't it? When I ask you to raise your arm, it would actually work out really nicely if you want to follow this through as I explain this. If it's safe to do so, I don't know where you are listening to this sermon, but if it's safe to do so, just follow with me, right? Imagine you are in the monastery, and I was doing the sermon on the stage, and then I'd ask you to actually do this as an experiment, and then because then it'll be a lot easier for you to understand what I'm trying to explain to you here, right? Okay, so raise your arm. Okay, smart ones among you. Okay, left arm. You didn't say which arm, Swami, so I don't know which one to raise. All right. Left arm. Raise your left arm. What did you just do there? Did you raise your left arm? Let's try that again. Put your arm back down. Okay, now raise your arm. Raise your left arm. No, I asked you to raise your left arm. You're not getting it, are you? Okay, put your arm back down again. Okay, now please listen carefully. Listen carefully and raise your left arm. You're not doing what I'm asking you to do. Now, I know you're confused at this point because you're wondering, Swaminas, you can't even see what we're doing. So how the heck are you saying that we're not doing what you're asking us to do? Let alone, why are you even saying I'm not raising my left arm? This is my left arm and I've got it raised. Anymore, if I raise it anymore, I'm going to hit the ceiling. What are you talking about? All right, let me explain. I asked you to raise your left arm. What are you actually doing? Let's walk closer. Let's go closer to your left arm. And let's see what's really happening there. Right? There are muscles in your arm. Aren't there? The muscles that surround the bones on your arm. Right? I asked you to raise your arm. And what you're doing is you're clenching those muscles. You're contracting those muscles. What did I ask you to do? I asked you to raise your arm. What are you really doing? You're contracting your muscles. Is that what I asked you to do? Now, think about this. I'm showing you a way to practice Kaya Anupassana, because if you get this, folks, you can, especially the gentleman who asked the question, you will find an answer to your problem. You'll be free. Isn't that what you're looking for? You're looking for freedom. You know, you are so, you'll excuse me for saying it this way. You're suffering from this problem so much that you wanted to type it out. You took the effort, you took the time, in and amongst your busy schedule, you took the time to type it out and send it to us. Meaning, it can't be just any old problem. It has to be a problem that you are serious about. It's bothering you, is it not? It's something you want to break free from, is it not? It's something that's keeping you in captivity and you want to break free, is it not? I'm trying to help you here. You have asked for help and I'm trying to help you here. So, pay attention, follow through this with me, and I promise you, if you get this concept, all of you. You'll all be free from all those pesky annoyances, wherever, all those instances where you thought the mind was willing but the flesh is weak. You'll be able to free yourself from that. Is this kaya anupassana? Contemplation on the body. Right, you still got your arm raised? Okay, put it down. Right, take a deep breath. Relax yourself. Right, okay. Put that arm up again, up back again. Now put your arm back up again. Right, again, you're not doing what I asked you to do. What did I ask you to do? Think carefully and answer. What did I ask you to do? I asked you to raise your left arm. What are you really doing? You're contracting the muscles of your arm. That is not what I asked you to do. Did you hear me at any point? You go back and rewind the tape and see if at any point I asked you to contract the muscles of your left arm. Did I ask you to do that? So why are you doing that? Why are you doing something I didn't ask you to do? I asked you to raise your left arm and you're contracting the muscles of your arm. That's not what I asked you to do. Okay, put your arm back down. Now I've got to remind myself to do that because I can't see you guys. So, hopefully. In the event I forget to mention to put your arm down, say in about 10 minutes, then please, you can put your arm down, okay? Otherwise, we might have another problem. You'll have your arm up for 3 hours and then you'll say, Swamin Mahansa, because of you, now my left arm can no longer, is of no use anymore. So, thank you anyway, I'm free from that problem now. That's not the way I want to free you from the problem. So now let's think about what happened there. I asked you to raise your arm, and what you did was you contracted the muscles of your arm. Isn't that right? How do we know this? Let's go and ask your arm. Imagine we gave your arm a voice. So you can speak, and independently your arm could also speak, right? So your arm can speak independent to you. Let's go ask your arm. What just happened? Why did you go up? Is what we're asking the arm. What are we asking? Why did you go up? What is the arm going to say in response to our question? Why did you go up? If the arm could speak, what would the arm say? What do you think? I think the arm's going to say, hey, there was nothing I could do. I couldn't stop myself. Right? That's what the arm's going to say. Just like you. Just like you say when you're in front of that cake or Kate. What you're going to, just as you say, I couldn't stop myself. What does the arm say? I couldn't stop myself. And then we ask the arm, why not? Why couldn't you stop yourself? Well, it's these muscles. Is those muscles, you see, those things, they contracted and there was nothing I could do to stop myself from going up. There was absolutely nothing I could do. And then we ask, but did you try at least? And then the arm goes, are you kidding me? When those muscles contracted, there is nothing on this planet I can do to stop myself from going up. I'm helpless. Nothing I can do. Absolutely nothing. Not all the willpower, not all the courage. Right? As this gentleman has said in his message to us, right? I keep jumping back to it just so we can relate this to the question, because I want you to walk away from this sermon with an answer that you're happy with, sir. What did it say? I don't have the courage to shift my mind from desire to contemplation. So you're saying you don't have courage, right? Just as well, because that's exactly what your arm is saying. I don't have not all the courage that I've got could stop me from going up. It's those muscles. You see those muscles? Just below the elbow is one end, and just by the shoulder is the other end. Go talk to them. Why are you asking me? You know, if going up was an offense, what would the arm say? I am not guilty. I did not do it by intention. It was not my doing at all. There was nothing I could do to stop. I'm speaking in this manner because I know there are young children on the sermon also, and I want them to understand this as well. So really, what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to take a very profound concept. I'm trying to simplify it as best I can in both its presentation and in the concept. So adults, if you're thinking, God, so I'm just get to the blooming point, well, there are young children on the call, on the sermon. So I'm trying to help them also understand the point. 7 years of age, they can get it. I promise you. Problem I have is sometimes, well, come they get it and you don't. So, what were you asking the arm? Why did you go up? We told you not to go up. Or rather, we told the arm, don't go up. And the arm could not. And what did you ask the arm to do? We asked you to raise your left arm, but really what you're doing is you're contracting your muscles. So what did we do? We moved closer to the arm. And then we asked the arm. We moved closer to the arm and we're inspecting what really happened. So this is an analysis of what happened there. Forensics, if you like. Something went wrong and we want to find out what went wrong. And we ask the arm, why did you go up? And the arm is saying, I swear to you, I had nothing to do with this. It wasn't me. It was those muscles. Go and talk to them and leave me alone. Wouldn't the arm say that? By arm, I mean everything except for those muscles. The pair of those muscles. I think they're called the biceps and the triceps. Right? If I remember my biology correctly. So except for those two pairs of muscles, or that pair of muscles, everything else, they're going to say, sorry, beats me. I don't know how it happened. It wasn't me. I was asleep. I was just minding my own business and whoa, I just went up. I'm like, what just happened? And it was those muscles. Go and talk to them. All right, let's go talk to the muscles then. Right? Let's go talk to the muscles. Muscles, yes. Why did you contract? Why did you contract? Because all we wanted was the arm to go up. But what happened? Muscles contracted. Now, yes, it is the muscles contracted which sent the arm up, but I didn't ask for you to contract muscles. All I asked was for you to raise your arm. So we are working through one by one and seeing. We are trying to figure out, essentially, folks, what we are trying to figure out is, where is this I that couldn't stop the myself? Where is that myself that couldn't be stopped? That's what you say, right? I couldn't stop myself. So there's no fault with I. Yeah? There's no fault with I because I wanted to stop. But what couldn't be stopped? The myself couldn't be stopped. So we're going to try to find this myself and, you know, have a word with it. Now, why don't you respect and obey I? How dare you, right? How dare you not obey and respect and listen to every word that I have to say? Why do you act on your own accord? You have to be obedient. Why are you disobedient? Is a question we want to ask myself. So we need to go and find this myself that couldn't be stopped by the I. So we're working our way, started with the arm, then we worked towards the muscles, and now we're asking the muscles, hello muscles, why did you contract? Why did you contract? When you ask these questions of the muscles, and the muscles, if they had a voice of their own, what would the muscles say? What would they say? Well, like any friend, any pair of friends, first they'd say, it wasn't me, it was him, go and ask the other guy. So the biceps would say that of the triceps, and the triceps would say that of the biceps. Right? But once we've gotten over that, you're both responsible for this, what happened? And then what they would say is, well, we don't know really. We were just minding our own business. We were just, you know, we were just chilling. And then there's this current. There's a signal that came from somewhere. It came from this nerve. See, this nerve. It came from this nerve. And those neurotransmitters fired, right? And then that got us all excited, right? And then there was nothing we could stop. It's like, you know, if someone were to tickle you, is there any point asking you, why are you laughing? Stop laughing. There's no point in doing that, is there? Because you just can't stop it. When you're excited, then you can't be stopped. And if someone tickles you, you're going to start laughing hysterically. And the only way that can be stopped is, if you say, stop laughing, you're going to have to say, well, can you ask the guy who's tickling me to stop tickling me, please? I can't help it. Likewise, these muscles, if you ask them, why did you contract? They're going to say, it's those neurotransmitters. Or it's that nerve. It carried a message to us. It sent an electrical shock, and we couldn't do anything about it. This is just a reaction. Not in our control. Completely out of our control. So please, leave us alone. Go and talk to whoever sent the signal. And the muscles would say, we couldn't stop ourselves. Right? If they had one voice, again they'd say, I couldn't stop myself. Now we've heard that story before, haven't we? How many times? We heard it twice now. Twice? Yes, you said it first. I couldn't stop myself. Your arm said it next. I couldn't stop myself. Now the muscles are saying the same story. I couldn't stop myself. So, where do we go from here? Well, it seems that when an electric signal comes to the muscles and they're excited, these motor neurons, they do their work. There is nothing these muscles can do except for contracting and relaxing. So what do we do now? We're going to have to go to the source of the electrical signal. Where did that come from? So why the nervous system, central nervous system, it came right all the way from the brain. Aha. It's usually the bad guy for most things. So let's go and talk to the brain. Now, for some of you, we're going to have to stop there. No, I'm just kidding. Everyone's got a brain. So we can have that conversation with everyone, right? So we go to the brain. Brain, why did you send a signal to those muscles? Why did you excite that motor neuron and send a signal to those muscles? We're asking the brain. What is the brain going to say? I just couldn't stop myself. Isn't the brain going to say the same thing? I couldn't stop myself. And then we might say, well, hey, come on. You know, we've heard that story before. Right? The arm said that first. Oh, no, actually, your owner said that first, or whoever claims to be your owner, he said that first, and then your arm said that, the arm said that next, and then the muscles said that next, and then after that, now you're saying it. You couldn't stop yourself. Well, yes, that is the truth. I couldn't stop myself. I just had to send that signal. It's not like I could apply the brakes. I couldn't stop. You know, like a line of dominoes, if one falls, then if one behind me falls, then I'm going to fall on the one in front of me. There's nothing I can do to stop it. I'm helpless. Don't talk to me. Who's the brain going to say, go and talk to? What do you think? Who's the brain going to say, go and talk to? Any ideas? You're all with me so far, right? This was the arm that was raised. I asked you to raise your arm, and that's not what you did, because I could see your muscles contracting. And therefore I came and asked you, hey, what are you doing? I asked you to raise your arm, why are you contracting your muscles? And then we took a closer view. We zoomed in, and we asked the muscles, hey, hello, why did you contract yourselves? First we asked the arm, and the arm said there was nothing I could do. The muscles contracted and I couldn't stop myself. And then we asked the muscles, why did you do that? And the muscles said what? I couldn't stop myself. Then we went to the brain, which is where we are right now. And we're asking the brain, why did you do that? Why did you send that signal? And the brain saying what? I couldn't stop myself. I couldn't stop myself. We asked, what do you mean you couldn't stop yourself? Well, there was a signal that came to me, a command, and there's nothing I can do. I can't disobey that command. If the command comes in, then I have to honor it. So, please don't ask me this, that, and the other. Please go and ask it or he or she that sent the command. Don't know where it came from, but it came from somewhere. Please go to the source and ask the source. Now, where did that come from? Now, those of you, of course, I think most of you will know the answer now. Where did that come from? Remember the old, when we used to talk about the doctrine. Do you remember those sermons? A long time ago, we talked about the five sense organs and the sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, right? And those external stimuli. Stimulating the five sense organs, and then signals fired, right? And through the brain, they went into the mind. Remember that? So that was the information coming in from the outside world. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch coming in from the outside world. Now, what's happening is, of course, the cake was seen and the arm was raised, wasn't it? So coming in was sight, eye, brain, mind, and then to raise the arm, well, it has to be the reverse then, mustn't it? Mind, brain, and then now muscles and arm. You all with me there? So first we ask the arm, right? We ask the arm first, why did you do that? Arm said, go, don't talk to me, go talk to the muscles. We asked the muscles. Then muscles said, don't talk to me, go talk to the brain. Then we talked to the brain. And the brain said, don't ask me, go ask the mind. And then we asked the mind. I'll jot it down here. Okay? Somewhere here. Alright? So now we are asking the mind. So now tell me then. We've hit a home run, haven't we? Have we not gone back to our source? Are we not at where it all started? You see, when the mind sends an instruction and the brain receives that instruction, is there anything in this world that the brain can do to disobey the instruction of the mind? Can the brain override the instruction of the mind? Think about those lines of dominoes. Lay down on the floor, one after the other. Right? If this guy falls, what can this guy do to not topple over the one next to it? Right? When this domino falls, what can this do to not topple over the one next to it? There's absolutely nothing. You know this is the principle of Charlie and Freddy? No, cause and effect. This is the principle of cause and effect. When the mind sends a signal to the brain can do nothing other than obey that signal. It may be, however, that sometimes the brain is not fully functional. Perhaps it's indisposed. Maybe there are chemical imbalances. Maybe it's just not the right time of the day. Whatever. There may be some biophysical reasons or biochemical, biophysical reasons as to why the parts of the body cannot respond to the impulse that comes from its predecessor. However, if they are fully functional, there is nothing they can do to not relay that message on. Will you agree with me on that? So when the mind says jump, what does the body have to do? It's got to jump. So when then the mind says raise your arm, what does the body have to do? It's got to raise its arm. Therefore, if you go and ask the arm, why did you raise yourself? Why did you raise yourself? It's fair enough for the arm to say, I couldn't stop myself. Yes or no? If the arm is the eye, yeah, so we are personifying the arm, right? Then the arm could speak for itself. It's fair enough for the arm to say, I couldn't stop myself because muscles contracted. There is nothing I could do to stop it. Stop this from happening. And then if you went and spoke to the muscles, the muscles could also say, I couldn't stop myself because there's a signal that came from the brain. And when that signal gets fired, provided I'm fully functional, provided I've got all the nutrients and all the cells in that make me up are functional and got the mitochondria and they're producing the power that's needed for me to go ahead and make those contractions, there is nothing that can be done to stop me. In a sense, what they're saying is, I am driverless. It is not me who's driving me. In essence, what they're saying is, I am not in charge. I am not in charge. So if I am not in charge, then what's the point of I being there? Right, think about that. I'm taking this one step at a time. If I am not in charge, meaning I can't stop what happens, when there are causes which have already lined up, there is nothing that I can do. To stop this from taking place. To stop this event. Does that also not mean that it wasn't... Now, I'm talking about the arm, okay? I'm talking about the arm and we're having a conversation with the arm. If the arm could not stop itself from moving up, from raising, was it the arm that raised itself? If the arm could not stop itself from raising itself, was it the arm that raised itself? Let me ask you the question in a way that you can more easily relate to. Right? Imagine you're a passenger in someone's car. Okay, you're sat in the passenger seat and there's a driver. So you're essentially he or she's driving and you're being driven, right? Now, you can see that a car has just pulled up in front. And you can see in a moment, you're going to crash into the car. What are you going to do? You're going to slam on the brakes. But hey, hang on, you're the passenger. Yes, you're still going to slam on the brakes. If you had any experience driving a car, so you know what needs to happen at that moment, as in, if you were in the driver's seat, what you would do is exactly what you would do in the passenger seat. You would slam on the non-existent brakes. You'd do it nevertheless, wouldn't you? But the car crashes into the car up ahead, into the car that pulled up in front. Now, here's the thing. You slammed the brakes on time, but the driver didn't. Because, say, he was looking out somewhere, he was not looking straight ahead, and the car just swerved in, and he was looking somewhere else. You slammed the brakes bang on time. Had you been in the driver's seat, the car would have stopped right on time, and a crash could have been prevented. But you were not in the driver's seat. You slammed the brakes on time, but the driver was a couple of seconds too late. Now, all that is fine, but here's my question. How come your slamming the brakes did not stop the car? How come? Because it was not your pressing the pedal that drove the car. That's why. In other words, if you're not the driver, you can't be the one who stops the car. Only the driver can stop the car. Meaning, if you can't stop the car, you're not the driver. If you're not the driver, you can't stop the car. So it works both ways. Right, let me say that up again, just so it's clear in your mind. When you applied the brakes, you applied the brakes right on time. If you had those pedals under your feet, the car would have stopped in time and the crash could have been prevented. But it couldn't be prevented because the driver, the real driver of the car, the actual driver of the car was 2 seconds too late and the car had a crash. Now, why did the car crash when in fact you applied the brakes at the right time? You know, with enough time for the car to stop and some distance sped. Why couldn't the crash be prevented? It's because you are not the driver. So you can't stop something when you're not the driver. Meaning, if you're not the driver, you can't stop it. And if you can't stop it, you're not the driver. So if you're not the driver, in respect to the car being driven, what is your role in the car? Right? Purely from the perspective of the car being driven, what is your role in the car? What is it? Absolutely nothing. Your being in the car has nothing to do with the car being driven or the car stopping or anything for that matter. Because that is why they call you the passenger. You have no control over the movement of the car. That's why you're called the passenger and you're not called the driver. Meaning, your presence there is unnecessary. Your presence is dispensable. Your presence adds nothing. I'm talking about the movement of the car. Okay? Your presence adds nothing. So likewise, when the arm is raised, and we walk up to the arm and ask the arm, why couldn't you stop yourself? It's because it wasn't the arm that raised itself. In other words, the arm is not the driver of the arm. If the arm was the driver of the arm, then the arm could stop the arm from being raised. Do you understand that concept? The arm is not the driver of the arm. So, how is the arm raised? Now you're asking a good question. Instead of asking, who raised the arm? Now you're asking, how was the arm raised? Now, you should remind yourself at this point, if you have a good memory, that was the kind of question, the question that the Buddha asked, invited his students to ask. Don't ask who, ask how. Remember we talked about this long time ago. When someone spilled some water. I've taught you this in the past. Don't ask the question who spilled water. Ask how was it spilled. Those days I used to explain it in a way that you could understand, because I said there's no point in trying to find who spilled water, because the who can be replaced by someone else and still the water can be spilled. Because if it's the same process, you get the same result. It's a process that determines the result. A process is a lineup of causes in serial fashion. One leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. That is how you have cause and effect. Didn't mean for that to be an F, that should be an E. Cause and effect. So Charlie and Eddie, sorry, not Freddy. It's a lineup of causes. So there is no driver then. In essence, really, the arm is not its own driver. I'll bet 80% of you have got this. But again, as I say, I'm always conscious that my audience is made up of 7-year-olds, sometimes even younger, to 70-year-olds, sometimes even older. Only the other day I was speaking to young Canadians. Last week, we have a monthly sermon to them. And would you believe it, there was among the children there, who I think range between 7, 8 to late 20s, there were children among them who listened to the sermons regularly. And I asked them, what are the magic words? The words that I had uttered in a previous sermon, but I didn't mention in last week's sermon. And they were bang on the money. So that's how I test if you really listen to the sermons, and they proved it. They listened to the sermons. Magic words? What are you waiting for? Talking about what are you waiting for? We were waiting for some of you to send us pictures. And some of you had. And I asked for them to be posted on, shared on our Skype group. There's a Skype group, isn't there? For the English sermon listeners. I saw one picture of a rice cooker, and someone had put a sticker on it, what are you waiting for? I was very kind of them to share it as an inspiration to others. So now their rice cooker has the words, what are you waiting for, on it. So when you're waiting for the rice cooker to cook your rice, and perhaps the rice cooker manual or on the display, it says, your rice will be ready in 20 minutes. There is something else that will be ready in 20 minutes. And that is what you're waiting for. So, thank you for sharing that. And I'm sure others will have done similar. I ask you to be creative. And it's always good to share them among others as a means of inspiration. So, back to the point. This is why I'm trying to simplify this as much as I possibly can. Because I know there are young children listening to this. And they can understand this just as much as the adults can. That I know. Right. So, as a passenger, you can't stop your car because you're not the driver. If you're not the one who's driving the car, you can't be the one who stops the car. To be the one who can stop the car, you also have to be the one who's driving the car. You get that? Yes. Likewise, when you ask the arm, why did you raise yourself? It's fair enough for the arm to say, I couldn't stop myself because I wasn't the one who raised myself, because I wasn't the one who was not raising myself. All this time, it wasn't me who was keeping myself from being raised. It wasn't me who had myself down. That was not my control. It was not my wish. I had nothing to say in this. I had no say in this. That is why we went past the arm and went to the muscles. And we asked the muscles the same question. So, as we moved from arm to muscle, did we not prove that this myself if the myself is the arm, then there is no I here. Because if there is nothing that is keeping the arm down, in other words, if the arm is not keeping itself down, and if the arm is not raising itself up, then the arm has no right to call itself I. Just like for someone who's in a car but has no control over its movement, they do not have any privilege to be called the driver. They have no right to be called the driver. There is no reason, no rationale for them to be called the driver. If you are called the driver, then you should be able to stop it, you should be able to move it at your will. And the same concept applies here. You'll understand why I'm emphasizing this point when we move a little further ahead to the brain and then a little further on to the mind. Then a lot of things will become clear to you. That's why I'm spending some time on the arm here, just because then it's just copy and paste from there on. So you get this once, you've got it. Right, so is it not obvious then to us that there is no I in the arm? Because if there was an I in the I could have stopped the arm and it would have been able to raise the arm. So the I in the arm would be responsible for its movement. But the arm says, no, there's nothing I could do. There were causes behind me, and when those causes manifested themselves, there was nothing I could do to stop myself. Right? So that's when we moved into the muscles. And the muscles had the same thing to say. Again, it is not the muscles that drive themselves. Therefore, it's not the muscles that can stop themselves. Meaning, there's no driver in the muscles. Meaning, there is no I in the muscles. So if the muscles were the myself, there is no I to stop the myself. But something kept the muscles from moving, and something then eventually moved the muscles. What was that something? That was the electrical signal that came from the motor neuron, which came via the central nervous system and via the spinal cord from the brain, the spinal column. So we went to the brain then and asked the brain the same question. Why did you do this? And again, we are personifying the brain and the brain saying, I couldn't stop myself. And now then, the moment the brain says, I couldn't stop myself, now we are questioning the validity of this I. Why does the brain call itself I? Is it within its right? Does it have the privilege to call itself I? In other words, that's a driver. Does the brain have the privilege to call itself a driver? Well, let's look. Let's check. If it is the driver, it should be the one that's moving. If it's the driver, it should be the one that's able to stop movement. But when we ask the brain, why did you and you alone, why did you and you alone get involved in the movement of the contraction of those muscles? What did the brain say? Beats me. I had nothing to do with it. There was nothing that I could do to stop it. It was out of my control. In essence, I am not the driver. So it's driverless. It's driverless. So we are going looking for the driver, aren't we? We're going looking for the driver, aren't we? What is the hypothesis we are trying to test here? The mind is willing. So there is someone who is willing, but the flesh is weak. So the driver wants to stop. Right? But the car doesn't. And that is what is being said here in this hypothesis. The driver wants to stop, but the car won't. Or the driver wants to move, but the car won't. The mind is willing, but the flesh is weak. The opposite of that was the flesh is willing, but the mind is weak. Now, we're going through each part of the flesh, in essence the body, and we are checking, was there any will in it? Was there any will? Was there any willpower when it came to the arm, when it came to the muscles? Did will have anything, as if not will, you know, will, not Jack and will, right? Will as in the want, the desire. Did will have anything to do with this movement? intention? Did it have anything to do with the movement? Was there any intention in the muscles? Was there any intention in the arm, in the bones, in the brain? Was there any intention? None whatsoever. It is because there was no intention there, each of them said within air quotes, each of them said, "Don't ask me, go and ask the guy before me. It's probably him." So we got to the brain so far. Then we move one step forward, or one step back, relatively speaking, and we move to the mind. Right? Now we move to the mind. In the mind, things are happening. Up to this point, we are absolutely clear on the point that if the mind sends a signal to the brain, there is nothing the brain can do except to obey the command. And if the brain receives a signal and it obeys that command, not if, when, it obeys that command, because the brain has no choice in obeying the command, therefore we can't say if the brain obeys the command. There's no choice here. So when the brain forwards that message on to the muscles have no choice again than to obey the commands. And then the muscles have to contract. When the muscles contract, there is nothing the arm can do. It has to raise. So when the causes line up, we can see how the effects are taking place. Now we've come all the way back to the mind. And now, let's ask the mind. So that's where we're going to be scratching our heads wondering, where do we go from here? Right? Where do we go from here? Let's ask the mind. Mind, why did you raise the arm? Now, here's the tricky part. If you ask yourself this question, right, let's bring the cake back into the picture again. It's time for that cake. Okay. And while I'm at it, I just reminded myself that this is not quite how Freud explained this. Just correct myself. What he said was, you had the, besides the point, oh no, we're not going to attain Nibbana Swaminathan because you explained it incorrectly. No, I'm talking about what Freud said. Right. He said, that was the superego. This was the id. And that was the ego. Right. Just to be clear on the point. Either way, essentially what his theory was that you had you had the conscious mind and the unconscious mind, right? The bit you can control and the bit you can't control. It's just like what you're feeling here. That's what you're saying here, right? There's a conscious part that I can control, and there's an unconscious part that I can't control. And he tried to explain this in terms of this concept of superego, ego, and id. And what he said was, id was the sort of the carnal side of the mind. Right? It would just go on its whims and fancies and whatever it wanted. You know, it's all the desires and all the impulsive stuff. That was all the id stuff. The superego was the ethical part of the mind. So this being the non-ethical part of the mind, you couldn't speak out loud the things that came in from the id. And then you had the ego, which kept the two in balance. So that was his theory. But that was his way of trying to explain how this moral battle that happens in the mind when you face the dilemma. How does the mind come to control itself? Okay, and then there were various behavioral patterns of mechanisms, defense mechanisms, as to how the mind would try to reconcile the good and the bad. So he had his own explanation for that. That's besides the point, but what I'm saying is there were people back in the day were also grappled by this problem, and they also wanted to find a solution to this problem. And they went about it this way, some of them. Whereas the Buddha's explanation of this is quite different. So we are at the mind now, and we brought the cake back into the picture. Excuse me. We brought the cake back into the picture, and here, the sight of the cake, right? Sight of the cake was what prompted the mind to send that impulse to the brain, was it not? In other words, you wouldn't extend your arm to pick up something that's not there, would you? Like previously, when we didn't have the cake here, there would not have been a reason to extend your arm. You know, you don't extend your arm to grasp something that doesn't exist. If you did, then they'd take you to a safe place and lock you there until you felt better. Right? So anyone in their sane mind would not be extending their limbs to reach out to grasp or grab something that does not exist. Now, would it not makes sense then for us to think of it in these terms. The sight of the cake, right? So, sight of the cake. These are not teardrops, by the way. This is the sight of the cake. Sight of the cake. Now, you know how this happens. We talked about this before, right? Sight comes into contact with the eye, and then again through the processing box, which is the brain, into the mind. Right? That bit we've spoken about before. All that, I think people are reasonably happy with. And people will even say, well, that's all vipaka, right, Swaminhansa, so we don't have any problem with that. But, you know, all this other stuff, like those examples that I asked you to come up with a moment ago, where you feel that it is the mind that is willing, but the flesh is weak. We're trying to find out what's really going on here. So you see, the sight of the cake, or sight of the cake, was what prompted the mind, because thoughts would have arisen in the mind, wouldn't it? At the sight of the cake, thoughts would have arisen in the mind. Like what sort of thoughts we'll talk about in a moment. Thoughts of the cake would have arisen in the mind, and following Manosankara, maybe sometimes Vachi Sankara, but most certainly Kaya Sankara. These are the formations. It's a bit like turning the cogs for something to happen. Right? Thoughts, mental processes, and then Vachisankara you could think of as verbal processes and formations, and Kaya Sankara, physical or bodily processes, formations. So this Kaya Sankara is now being driven by the mind. Is that not clear to us now? Because what was our last pit stop? We went and asked the brain, why brain did you send those signals to the muscles? And the brain said, I there was nothing I could do to stop myself. The mind said, go, and I had to go. So that proved to us that there is no I that's driving the brain. The brain is being driven by another source. So we came looking for that source and we discovered that it was the mind. Now we are at the mind when you're asking ourselves, is there something driving the mind or is the mind the driver of it all? That is what we're asking ourselves now. Is there something that's driving the mind or is the mind the driver? I'm not going to give you the whole story for today because I want you to take this one piece at a time. Let's take this piecemeal. I want to give you something to think about. That is why I've put that picture of the cake back there and I'm asking you the question, had it not been for the sight of the cake, would the mind have generated these thoughts as instructions to the brain to send signals to the muscles to contract themselves, to extend the arm, to reach out for the cake? Had the sight of the cake not have happened, had it not happened, right? Had the sight of the cake not happened, would the mind have generated the thoughts, Kaya Sankara, for the brain to extend the arm by contracting the muscles to reach out for the cake? Would that have happened, do you think? Not anyone in their sane mind would do that. If there's nothing to grasp, you wouldn't extend your arm to grasp the thing that does not exist. In which case, do you not see that there is a connection between the sight, which as we know is a vipaka? Do you not see that there's a connection between this vipaka, which is the sight of the cake, and what for now feels like the karma? Right? I can forgive you for thinking that this is the karma for the time being. I will revisit these concepts in future sermons. But for the time being, I can forgive you. You can be forgiven for thinking that this is the karma. But my question being, is it not driven by this vipaka? Had it not been for the vipaka of the cake, the sight of cake, would the mind have generated those thoughts as instructions to the brain to send a signal to the muscles to contract, to extend the arm? Do you not see a loop here? It starts with the cake, to the brain, to the mind, to the brain, to the arm, to the cake. So starts with the cake, ends with cake. So starts with vipaka. And for the time being, you can... I'll let you think that it ends with karma. Because you feel that the karma bit here is actually extending your arm to grasp the cake. That is the bit you're saying, I am struggling with, please Swaminathan, help me. Isn't that right? Because that's what you're saying, the flesh is weak. Right? The mind is very virtuous, is what essentially you're saying. My mind is God, it's like Mahatma Gandhi, but my flesh is like Adolf Hitler. Please help. My mind is like a saint, but my flesh my body, it's the devil. So you seem to have this grudge against your body, or a grudge with your body, because your body seems to be doing all sorts of mischievous and getting up to no good. Is that fair? Is that a fair assumption or a fair analysis and a fair conclusion of what's going on here? See, was it not the vipaka that prompted the mind to fire up and then those signals to go into the brain, down to the muscles, to extend the arm, to grasp the cake? So, had it not been for this vipaka, in essence, had the cake not been there, right, I'm going to move the cake back out again. Had the cake not been there, would the mind have generated thoughts to the brain as instructions to contract the muscles, to raise the arm or to extend the arm? Would that have happened? No. I think it's clear to you that. So, for where I want us to get to today, because we just started off trying to prove or disprove the hypothesis. Is the mind willing and the flesh weak, or is the flesh willing and the mind is weak? Now, tell me then. Even if you got and understood as far as coming to the mind, right? Even if you got to that point, right? And forget the cake part and the vipaka and how that is what spurs everything into action, right? Even if you leave out that last bit, you can still answer this question. Which part of the body is driving itself? Which part of the body is driving itself? Which part? No part. The body is not driving itself. Each and every part of the body, if engaged in movement, that movement is the result of causes. And those causes, when you line up, it appears that the mind is at the root of it all. So, in which case, going back to the question, when it comes to some desires, the body reacts before the mind. So it's so hard to remind my mind of the foolishness of indulgence. Right. Do we have now enough evidence to, well, you tell me, accept or reject that theory? When did the body act on its own accord? When has it ever made decisions for itself? When did the arm ever go fishing by itself? When did the arm ever extend itself with no stimulus, with no instruction coming from the mind? So is it ever possible then that, is it ever possible? Because, you know, it is, as I said, you know, from time to time, when things happen, what sort of things? Like the things that we took examples of earlier. When things happen, it's easy for the mind to think, or it is easy for us to think that, you know, I'm so virtuous, I'm so diligent, and I'm so disciplined. But look at the body, it's so disgusting. Look at what you just did. And you tell the body off for it. But there is nothing in the body that happens without the mind driving it all. So even if things are happening in quick succession, it is still the mind that is driving all of it. Through the creation of Manosankara. And those Manosankara, Kaya Sankara. This Kaya Sankara is a product of the mind. Kaya Sankara is a product of the mind. That is why when the mind enters the jhanic states, in particular the fourth jhanic state, remember it is the mind that enters the jhanic state, not the body. When the mind enters the fourth jhanic state, then all Kaya Sankara comes to a stop. So then that is like the mind going into hibernation. Not quite. You could think of it as the mind, as the mind going into sleep or hibernation would be the likes of the ninth jhana, which is the Nirodha Samapatti. But we are talking about the aspect of the mind which is responsible for providing energy to drive the body, that department, if you like, that division, goes into hibernation. So it's like, imagine it's an organization and there are various departments that drive various aspects of this entity. So there's one department that's responsible for the thinking, another department responsible for speech, and another department responsible for bodily actions. Well, the department that's responsible for the bodily actions, the Ministry of Bodily Actions, right, they go into hibernation in the fourth jhana. This is the mind that does that. When the mind goes into the fourth jhana, the samapatti, the absorption state, then Kaya Sankara comes to a stop. So, let us first, the whole point of this explanation has been, as I said right at the beginning of the sermon, before we fix a problem, we first need to identify where the problem is. Are you all in agreement then that this notion that the mind is willing but the flesh is weak is entirely flawed? But it is one that people have learned to say. People have come to use that, and I've heard it many times used in society where people will often offer that as an excuse. I tried my best. I tried my best. I honest to you, I swear to God, I tried my best. It was not me. It was something within the body that just completely possessed me. Yeah, you can't blame me for it. I'm not responsible. It was this finger. Curse the finger. No, it was never like that. It was never like that. It has been the mind all along. If you ask me, that is good news. Because the Buddha does not teach us a method to tame the body. He teaches us a method to tame the mind. It is the disciplining of the mind through which the rest of it happens. The Buddha says in the Dhammapada, Kaya na sangaro sadhu, sadhu vachaya sangaro. మనసా సంగరు సాధు, సాధు సబ్బత సంగరు, సబ్బత సంగుతో భిక్కు సబ్బ దుఃఖ పముచ్చతి. The superficial meaning, and there's a much deeper and profound meaning which we will talk in future. Kayana sangaro sadhu, restraint of the body is good. Sadhu vachaya sangaro, good is restraint of speech. Manasa sangaro sadhu, restraint of the mind is good. Sadhu sabbata sangaro, restraint of all is good. Sabbata sanguto bhikkhu, one who has restrained it all is a bhikkhu. Sabba dukkha pamuchyati, and frees himself from all suffering. Essentially, what he is saying, if you dig deeper into those words, and which we will do in future sermons, what he's essentially saying is, go and try and find the I that's not able to stop myself. That's what he said by sabbata sangaro bhikkhu. Sadhu sabbata sangaro, go and find this I who claims to be the driver. Go and find the driver if you can, and tame him. Tame the driver. Once you've tamed the driver, now we have a bhikkhu. One who has surpassed all suffering. See, this is exactly what we are doing here with our study. Trying to find the driver. Trying to find this self that couldn't stop myself. Trying to find the I that couldn't stop myself. So far we've gotten as far as the mind. And hopefully you'll agree with me that we can no longer make this claim that the mind is willing but the flesh is weak. Any action that is intentional is entirely the responsibility, categorically 100% the responsibility of the mind. Will you accept that? It is on that premise that any further discussion is worthwhile. So really, all we can say is, the flesh is willing. The flesh is always willing. But the mind is weak. In the case of an arahant, the flesh is willing. What, just after he became an arahant? No, he was always willing. But now the mind is strong. Why? The mind has been restrained. The mind has been tamed. And therefore now words as well as actions appear to be tamed. And that's because behind the curtains, the driver, the conductor, the orchestrator, that is the mind, has been tamed. Tamed how? That we'll talk about later. Let's bring the cake back into the picture. One last time. It's not a sermon if we don't bring a piece of cake back in, eh? Remember once someone asking Guru Swami Nuhansi's sermon? He always talks about cake. Is that all people are attached to? Fair question. He always does talk about cake. So, cake, back into the picture. Now, I said substitute cake with whatever it is that has always piqued your interest and whetted your appetite and gotten you excited. Right? So, I'm going with cake. Gentlemen who asked me the question can substitute cake with whatever. The sight of the cake is a vipaka. That much we know. However, the moment the mind receives this, it is the mind that controls the entire process from there on. When a sight and eye come into contact, what is born is consciousness, a thought. Following on from that thought, a series of thoughts, like the line of dominoes. One follows the other, follows the other, follows the other, follows the other, and so on. A series of thoughts follow. And among these thoughts will be vipakas and there will also be karmas. And perhaps also kriya, actions. So we need to carefully and skillfully work out what bit is exactly the vipaka, what bit is the karma. Because it is the cessation of karma that we are interested in on our pursuit for Nibbana, not vipaka. And all this karma, which again is the intention, as the Buddha said, put it quite succinctly, abhisankara. It is the cessation of abhisankara, sabba sankara, samato. You know this now. It is the stopping of all formations, or sankara. That is Nibbana. So you see how everything fits together. Right? So when you see this piece of cake, it is not the flesh that is weak here. Sir, madam, it's not the flesh that's weak here. The flesh is willing to do whatever the mind asks it to do anytime. Provided it's fully functional, the mechanics of it are intact, right? Everything's fully in full working order. Provided all of that is in its right balance, then the flesh is willing to do whatever the mind demands of it. We need to identify that is where the problem can lie. The problem is with the mind. That is where the problem is. So any remedy we need to apply to the mind. I'll repeat the question. I have a problem. I check my YouTube history as advised by Swami Nuhansi. And that is why, as you have done, as we have asked you, sir, an entire sermon has been dedicated to you. See? Doers will most certainly win. And I found out my desires for watching films and other stuff still exist. Every time I go on YouTube to watch them, I keep trying to apply practically the Dhamma. Well, now you are better armed with the Dhamma. Now you know the workings of it, how it's working inside of you. Right? We will, in a future sermon, we will go one step further. And you will realize, in your quest to identify, to spot the driver, that, well, you'll be surprised. Trying to apply practically the Dhamma as I understand it, but most of the time I cannot apply the Dhamma at the moment. The only reason you cannot apply the Dhamma to the degree that you want to is because there may be gaps in your understanding of the Dhamma. That is why. Otherwise, your application, there's no reason why the application cannot happen. When you're lacking in some aspects of your understanding, then it is those aspects which will suffer in the application. That's all it is. So that is what we're doing. That is why the sermons. To reinforce you. with the Dhamma. I know at the end of the act it is useless and nothing to be gained, but I don't have the courage to shift my mind from desire to contemplation. To shift my mind, to shift your mind to contemplation, you need to first be skilled. You need to be knowledgeable about the working, the going-ons. What's going on in your mind? That is how you can contemplate. So now, your contemplation can be further improved with the new knowledge that you may have gained today. And essentially, you'll understand that it is the mind that is wholly responsible for what's going on here. At that moment, I ask my mind the question, why do you want to indulge in it? And the answer comes back as it gives me pleasure. We'll talk about that also. To further examine the pleasure, because now we've gotten to a good point that it is the mind here that is responsible for all of this. In a future sermon, we can go back and study how this pleasure, this intoxication, this indulgence creeps into the mind, and how it has to respond to it, why it becomes susceptible to that vexation, and why the thirst for pleasure is so strong. Before I think, my mind jumps into indulgence. When it comes into some desires, the body reacts before the mind. So that, hopefully, you understand today, is not really what happens. What can I do about this, Amin answer? Please, can you point out my weakness? I think we've spotted one of the flaws in thinking. So that has been corrected, hopefully, today. I'm sure it has. Anyone can understand. So if you've understood this, excellent. Go back and listen to the sermon one more time. If you haven't understood this, still, go back and listen to the sermon one more time, at least. And as we work through this, the process here, more and more, you'll begin to realize that this is all a process. Ultimately, you will come to the conclusion that this is a driverless process. But we don't need to jump our guns just yet. We'll take it one step at a time. Some people may work it out sooner than others. Others will take a little time, but that's okay. We're not in any rush. But nevertheless, we're always heedful. So we don't waste our time, but we're not in a rush. Okay. I'm going to conclude the sermon there for today, because I think we've given you enough to ponder over the course of the next week. Go back and reflect on it a few times, and you may have questions following a revisit, in which case then you may feel free to send them through the normal channels, and when appropriate we'll pick them up to provide an answer. Okay, let us take a moment then to transfer the merits we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, chanting Pirit, listening to the Dhamma and engaging in various meritorious deeds today. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching. And with immense gratitude, let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down to the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also transfer the merits we have acquired to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief pillars of all the chapters who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us not forget that among them are the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to Guru Swami Nuhansa and all other monks resident at this monastery, as well as the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits and express our gratitude to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these sermons, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them, and may through the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plane, redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May through the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer the merits we have acquired to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who have contributed to the construction of the monastery to those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who have passed on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May through the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble life for path and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews, nieces, our elders, friends and acquaintances, employers and employees, and to all those who have helped and supported us, assisted us in any way, shape or form. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakkadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who are committed to protect and fulfill the Samudra Shasane. Let us also transfer merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. And may through the power of these merits they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to our ancestors who have predeceased us, to all who have been our families, friends and acquaintances in this infinitely long journey in samsara, and who have helped us, supported us, assisted us in any way, shape or form they could. Let us transfer these merits to them. Let us also transfer merits to the members of the armed forces as well as the members of the police force who have sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation and continue to do so. May all who have lost their lives in the war, be they friend or foe, rejoice in the merits we have acquired today. Let us also transfer merits to all those who have lost their lives in natural calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides and pandemics, reminding ourselves that among them will be those who have been friends and family to us in this long journey in samsara. Let us take a moment to transfer merits to them. May through the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in woeful planes, redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, let us all resolve that may through the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of Arahat and Vahanses and Arahat Meheni Vahanses on this blessed land. And finally, may through the power of all the merits we have acquired today, you and I and everyone who has helped make this program a success, become an Arahat and Vahanse or an Arahat Meheni Vahanse in his very life and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. We will now conclude the sermon for this week. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you.